I'm still John. I'm still a compulsive eater.
Hi, John.
Hey, guys. I found my pictures. As it turns out, I thought I forgot to bring them, and I had never taken them out of my thing from when I did my last retreat in San Antonio. So I'm going to pass them around. I don't have pictures from when I was at my top weight because it was when I was drinking, and nobody. I was very isolated for the most part, and also if you came at me with a camera, you took your life in your hands. But there's also these pictures of Jim and Dan that I mentioned who passed away. So I'm going to pass those out and just have them keep going around. A couple little. Did everybody sleep okay last night? You did okay? You have a nice bonfire? I was pooped. I couldn't make it. Got home. Got back safely to your things. It's funny. I do this retreat in northern San Diego, and they meet up in the woods, sort of like this. And the guy who was like Sean, who comes to give the announcements at the beginning, says, "Make sure you bring a flashlight with you when you're walking back to your cabin, because there are bears." And I go, wouldn't it be ironic to be compulsively overeaten at an OA event? You know, it would have been an interesting thing. I just want to make a couple of little commercials here. If anybody has not heard of the OA birthday party, we have it every year in January, Martin Luther King weekend, at least for the next 3 years. It is a wonderful event. There is everything you can imagine. There are multiple workshops and panels and marathons going on. We have a big book workshop. It's been led in the past by Harlan and Laurie. This year it's going to be led by somebody who's world-renowned. He's not actually – he's in AA, but he's world-renowned big book guy. And we had 800 people last year, 800 compulsive eaters and wonderful recovery. And most of the people that are on the LA podcast, you will be there. And it is I believe it's like $45. It's not a lot of money. And it's at the LAX Hilton, which is right at the airport. So you don't need a car, and you can just grab the shuttle in. And I think it's like $119 for a room, and you can put up to four people in a room. So it's a pretty economical thing, if especially coming from Portland. Unless there's a snowstorm like what happened last year, right? But so think about it. These bookmarks are on the back table, and if some of you would like to take extras to bring back to your meetings, I did bring a lot, so please feel free to do that. The other thing I'll mention is, I don't know how many people have heard of the Vision for You phone meeting, but it's a really wonderful meeting the East Coast meeting gets 400 or 500 people on the meeting. They've just started a West Coast meeting. It's one meeting every day, 7 a.m. in the morning. If you're getting ready for the day, it's a big book study, meaning they read a little piece of the big book and then people will talk about it, you know. And then on Sundays, they have a thing called a special edition, which are always on different topics. One person will share. I'm doing one in a couple weeks. And I left cards back on the back table too. It's the Vision for You group, and it's a phenomenal group. I did their convention a couple years ago, and incredible amount of recovery. So many people on the phone line will say, "I was banging around in OA for like a couple of years, and I couldn't get it together until I started coming to that program." Yes.
Is that Western
time? Yes. There used to only be one meeting, which was 7 a.m. Eastern. Which I'm sorry, as much as I love program, I'm not going to have a 4 in the morning. But now there is one on the West Coast, which is 7 a.m. Pacific time. And like I said, it's a great group, and I'd really recommend it. It's got phenomenal recovery going on.
Is that a big book study group?
It is a big book. What? It's called A Vision for You. It's a big book. Yes, it is A Vision for You. They actually have a website, avisionforyou.info. I think the 4 is the number. The other thing about that website, and it's on the card, is they have a huge archive of not only the meetings but the special editions. And I did one on relapse. I've done one on like step 6 and 7. I did one on fear. And Laurie and Harlan and a lot of other people have done them. And so you can go grab those and download those. And finally, I'll be talking a lot, especially this morning, about relapse. If anybody's really, really been having trouble with relapse and it's been going on for a while, please see me at one of the breaks or, at lunch or something like that. No, I'll talk to you further, but give you something. Okay, so anyway, we're back. I was saying last night, and I'll try and be funnier. I'll try not to talk about any more dead people. How's that? Okay? Because I find that tends to, you know, you lose the humor value when you start enumerating dead people. Except for really sick people. So the thing that I had the hardest time when I was going through this relapse and when I was coming in, when I say coming in, I mean once I got past that little pink cloud time I had, is I couldn't really understand the disease, the idea of the disease concept. You know, I mean, I was your good little student. I came in and you told me it was a disease, and I started, you know, parroting what you told me. Oh, yeah, it's a disease, you know. I would say that, but deep down, it took me years to look back and go, I didn't believe that, really. I think there was a part of me that said, look, if it makes you guys feel good to call it a disease, fine. But I don't think I really, deep down, believed it, you know. But the longer I'm around, the more I work this program, the more I really get that. You know, I go with this program a little differently. I think I have a little bit more of a, I don't know, scientific bent. And I believe everything that is in this big book, but I also... The physical addiction, it helps me to really get validated that this is a disease, you know. Obviously, it's a spiritual and emotional disease, but there is definitely a physical disease part of it, you know. The hardest thing for me was being able to understand what was me and what was the disease. You know, where did I stop and the disease began? You know, it's hard because we're dealing with a disease that's in our brain as opposed to, you know, physical diseases. And I believe they're finding out more and more every day about addiction and about these things, that we will eventually have a lot more scientific basis for this, because it's happened already. In the big book, there's sections which talks about, you know, we used to be able to take and leave alcohol, and all of a sudden we passed that invisible line, and we couldn't just do that anymore. And that was from 1937, but they have found that there is an enzyme in the human body called alcohol dehydrogenase that will burn out if you've drank too much. It's also, in certain ethnic groups, it's not there. But it validates the fact that what these guys were saying in 1937 was true. And I believe as we go along more and more, they find out things about, like, brain scans about addicts. And when addicts, you know, do whatever their substance is, their brains light up in a particular way. They can even show them pictures of that substance and their brains will light up. So, it, you know, just in a way, it helps me understand and believe this stuff. You know, early on in OA, a lot of, you know, the gray sheet thing about, you know, a lot of us had a problem with sugar and flour. Well, you know, what is it, about 10, 15 years ago, they start finding out about the Atkins diet and the glycemic index. And that, yeah, you know what, blood sugar spikes are a big part of why we eat something and then and get hungry like an hour or two after we eat when we shouldn't be hungry. And I know that's certainly with me, you know. And the thing that makes it hard is because this is a disease that resides in my brain, you know, it's hard sometimes, but there are other ones out there. There is, you know, schizophrenia. There is epilepsy. You know, nobody ever watches somebody who's just had an epileptic seizure and go, God, didn't you learn the last seizure? We get that this is something. Well, we have the same kind of thing, only it manifests itself through the compulsion, you know, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. You know, and when we talk about, you know, most of us get this if we're talking about something like cancer, right? If most of us, if you've gotten to my age, you've had at least one or two friends who've gotten cancer, and a lot of them, thank God, have gone into remission. But you don't say to them, God, how stupid are you to get cancer, right? And when they go into remission, and if they have another problem, God, are you stupid? Didn't you learn the first time? Yet we're horrible people for having had a relapse and all that. And the thing about cancer is, if you think about cancer, it is something they are growing in their bodies. They don't want it to be there, but they are growing it. Well, it's the same thing as us. We are having these thoughts. We don't want them, and we have to do something about it. Now, just like people with cancer, they've got to take their chemo. They've got to go maybe do radiation. We've got to do the things we have to do to keep this arrested a day at a time. And you know, it involves, you know, again, the part of my disease it took me so long was, again, like I said, figuring out where I stopped and the disease started. In the big book, they talk about, and more about alcoholism, they say, it is parallel with our sound reasoning. In other words, so much of my brain can be utilized to take care of so many other of my problems in my life. But when it comes to this disease, you know, it doesn't work. You know, we have a lady in our area who has the greatest line. She says, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain, you know. And it's really true. I need help. I need a power greater than myself. And, you know, the thing is, I couldn't understand that for a while. I couldn't understand how the disease worked in my life. And it came to me later as a result of the relapse. I always say that for me, my disease is like the world's best salesman. You know, think about somebody you know who's a salesman, right? And they're smooth and they're likable, right? And they're great talkers and they like their product and they're, you know, they know you like the product, right? Food, you know, and this salesman is so smooth. And here's the key. He can also read your mind. Imagine if you went to buy a car and the salesman's putting the hard sell on you and everything you want to say as to why I need to think about it, he's got the answer and he's ahead of you. Well, that's what my disease of compulsive eating does. And the other thing is my salesman is there 24/7, you know. My disease is there 24/7 and keep trying to make the sale, keeps trying to make the sale. And so the really, you know, tough part of that is that if that salesman does make the sale, and I went and binged, that salesman would then put its arm around me and say, oh, and by the way, this was your idea. You know, it wasn't my idea. In the middle of my worst part of my binge, I remember I'm going to 3 to 5 meetings a week. I have a sponsor. I am sponsoring. I am the intergroup rep from one of my meetings. I am the secretary of this artist in abstinence meeting. Now, both being a sponsor and the secretary, I shouldn't have been doing because I was in relapse. But I remember leaving that artist in abstinence meeting and on the way home, just driving into the donut shop and buying donuts. And as I'm leaving, I'm going, why am I doing this? I mean, I'm not sentenced to OA, you know. Over in the other program, you know, you have people who sign court cards because the judge has sentenced them to come. I didn't have to be there. And I couldn't understand, why am I doing this? And the reality is that it was this salesman, the disease made the sale, you know. I'm buying this thinking, oh, in the moment of impulse, I want this. No, I don't want it. If I really wanted it, I wouldn't have been going to 5 meetings a week. I wouldn't have been a sponsor. I wouldn't have been an intergroup rep. I wouldn't have been doing any of these things. And I guarantee everybody who's here right now doesn't want to compulsively overeat, or you wouldn't be here, right? You've got better things to do with a weekend. But in that moment of impulse, that salesman says, this is something you want to do, you know? And the other thing that's so tough about this disease is it will constantly morph. You know, there was a movie and a book years ago called The Andromeda Strain. I don't know if many of you guys remember that. And it was all about the scientists are trying to make this disease, you know, and it keeps morphing. Well, that's what happens with my disease, you know. I'm in that relapse and realize I'm in that relapse 14 years into program. So my disease isn't saying the same thing to me then that it was saying when I first walked in the door because I have too much information. The trouble is my disease is also using perfectly good program things as to why I should be eating, which is just, you know, again, it's the insanity. And you know, again, I have a disease. I have to take my medicine, like all addictions. It's the allergy of the body, you know, the obsession of the mind. As my friend Laurie always says, to put it in another way, I couldn't stop once I started, and I couldn't stop from starting again, you know, which is what this was for me. But the hardest thing, I think, about having this kind of a disease is that if I want to battle this disease, I got to realize that sometimes it's going to feel like I'm battling myself, you know. But I'm not. I'm battling a disease that resides in me. And the answer, I believe, at the end of the day, is the steps. For long-term recovery, it's the steps. Yes, you can work the diet in the beginning, and that'll work for a while, but it's really about the steps. And I think there is such a wonderful, perfect flow to the steps. One flows to the other, to the other, to the other. And I always say that, for me, I look back, and my recovery has sort of had two phases, okay? One was steps 1, 2, and 3, and the tools were what helped me get the food down and hold it down. But then 4 through 12 were how I was able to work through the things so that I wouldn't want to eat again, you know. We need to do all the rest of the steps. People I've known, I know people have gone out after 5-7 years and almost invariably have stopped, you know, trying to enlarge their spiritual condition and keep working on the steps. Complacency is a killer in this program. That's the one thing, you know. You know, you hear people coasting in program, and somebody said once, you know, there's only one way to coast on a bike, and that's going downhill, you know. And it's true, you know. I mentioned before my mother stopped drinking for 30 years before she passed away, but she stopped going to meetings. She didn't want to have anything to do with these guys, and she didn't want the steps. But because of the situation, she had hit a hard bottom. She didn't have to be around alcohol. She didn't drink again. I wouldn't want her sobriety. She was not a happy person. But I think sometimes with some of those diseases where you can put it down totally, you can get away with that. I don't think we have that. We don't have that luxury because it's there constantly. We have to do the work or we're not going to do it, you know. And so, you know, if you're at step zero, as they say, you know, step zero, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, you know, there's the answer, you know. And that doesn't have to happen to you the first day you come through the program, but at some point, you know, you've got to get it. And then even sometimes after you're in program, you're just in meetings going, something's just not right. And that's what happened with my slip, you know. And I remember going through my, you know, when I was in my, and I don't like the word slip. It's such a passive word, isn't it? You know, oh, I'm walking down the street, and, oh, I slipped, and there's cheesecake in my mouth. No, right? No, I planned it, I did it, and I like to say slip because it somehow took away, look, I went and did it. I had a relapse. I there were 1,000 steps I could have done between me and that first compulsive bite, but at that moment I didn't. But, you know, I've had sponsees who you know, have had, you know, gone, has slip relapse and come back and say, well, you know, God, this happened and I ate because of this. And a lot of times they're really valid problems, you know, a divorce or, you know, something really horrible. And they say, well, I ate because of that, I ate because of this. I go, no, you ate because you're a compulsive eater, you know. You know, think about it. When that really horrible thing happened to you, did you think about placing a bet on a horse? No, you know why? Because you're not a compulsive gambler. But I guarantee you there's a sponsor in GA who heard, I put a bet on a horse because this happened and that happened and happened. See, the thing with compulsive eating is food isn't the problem. Food is the solution, right? Food is the solution. And that's what I need to remember, you know? I'm a real believer in that it has to be first things first. You know, I'm a real, again, like I said, the intensely practical part of this is, you know, I have to do the work, you know. We got a guy named Al S. down in L.A., and he's been in OA for over 40 years. Doesn't go that much to OA meetings anymore, but he's got over 50 in AA. He's like a circuit speaker in AA. And Al's like one of these crusty old-timers who says things that a lot of us wouldn't say out loud at meetings. And he got up one day and said, you know what the trouble with OA is? There's too many people who found God before they found a food plan. And I was like, yikes, but there's a certain truth in that, you know. Let me talk about the things I was saying during my relapse. And if anybody's in relapse, maybe these sound familiar because, again, these were all excuses. My disease was whispering in my ear and rationalizations. I would say, well, I'm going to work on the steps first and then I will get abstinent, you know. Well, you know, I've read that book I don't know how many times, and nowhere in there does it say, you know, do all this stuff and then you will want to be sober, you know. Let me just say, have I sat in a meeting and heard a speaker say they did it that way? I'd be lying if I didn't say no, I didn't. Occasional, rare situations I've heard that. But, you know, for every one of those people who was somehow able to get that miracle that way, there's 100 people out there who, having heard that, are hoping they're going to get that lottery ticket. And they keep coming back, waiting for the absence fairy to hit them on the head. You know, keep coming back. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it has to be about more than that. And that for most people, it doesn't work that way. You know, I think it's about getting a food plan. It's about a day at a time, cleaning up. And you know, people, well, I'm going to start with a very flexible. Well, I find if you're hit that point of surrender, that's probably your point of greatest surrender. Make it tight in the beginning and then open it up. I mean, that's just an opinion I have. The other things I would do is, my absence, you know, what's my absence? It's pretty much whatever I'm doing right now. You know, I would do this thing of, my food plan is 3 meals and a snack. you know, which meant that anything I ate after dinner was a snack, you know, and I would end up eating more at dinner because I'm a grazer anyway. I never very rarely ate to the point of being in pain, but boy, I just didn't put food down very much during the day. Or then I would be like, well, in my absence, I want to be gentle with myself. That was another thing I would say, you know. So I'd have a food plan that Henry VIII could follow, you know. You know, well, wonderful. What's that accomplishing, you know? Or the other thing, well, I can't be on a diet. You know, I can't be on a diet. Well, you know what? We're all on some kind of diet, aren't we? I've been on a no-liver diet since I left my mother's house, right? You know, and we all have something like that. So, you know, again, these are things my disease wants to whisper to get me to not look at how to do recovery. You know, or, you know, I remember going through this, you know, again, I'm slipping and sliding, and I'm still going to meetings and talking about it at meetings. And I remember I came in and I was like, well, I binged last night, but I'm not going to beat myself up over it, you know. And then I came back a couple days later, well, I binged last night, but, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up over it. And about the third time, this old timer came up to me after the meeting and she said to me, did you ever consider that binging last night was beating yourself up? And it's like, ow, having to hear that. But it's true. How can I go do something that is deliberately self-destructive and then go stand in front of a mirror and say, you know, you're a good person? Well, if I really believed that, I wouldn't have done that the night before. But that's the problem. My disease will find anything it can to excuse it, to make it not a problem. Because if it's not a problem, I don't have to take care of it. And that's what happened for a long time. I remember I was talking about binging one day, and I was like, hey, man, well, you know, I guess I just haven't hit a bottom yet, you know? Oh, somebody came up to me after the meeting and said, you know, bottom isn't the goal here. You know? And the other ones, I'm praying for the willingness to stop. I'm praying for the willingness. You know, I went to a convention once, and like one of the keynote speakers said, you know, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know, it's really about pain. It's about pain will drive you to the willingness, you know. But I found that using that willingness while I'm praying for the willingness was another way my disease was whispering in my ear, you know. You know, and the other thing, again, I mentioned, you know, if you have meet like me and you're more than one program, well, at least I'm not drinking, you know. But my all-time one was, I'm redefining my abstinence, you know. I'm redefining, and, you know, I remember about the 10th time I did that, a little voice in my head said, you know, John, you broke your abstinence. You're just redefining your honesty, you know. And that was like one of those thoughts that hits me out of nowhere. That I'm like, huh. And that's, I sort of think it's my higher power. But all of those things I'm talking about, they were all about one thing. My disease had one job to do every day when I got up, and that was to figure out how to get me to kick the can down the road one more day on not putting the food down. Because it knew if it could get me to not put the food down today, it could probably get me to not put down the food tomorrow, and so on and so on and so on. And if I could do it by, well, I'll work on the steps, or, oh, I'll just work on my spirituality, you know, whatever it could do, it would do, because it knew that for most people, the basic first thread is getting the food down. And it doesn't mean it's easy, you know? But let's face it, we're in a program based on Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics have to stop drinking, you know? They can't say I'm sober, you know, and still keep drinking. And why would we think that it would work any differently for us? But I did at one point. I think one of the things that happened, we've lost track of some of the things that I learned early on in my other program about have a list of phone numbers in your pocket to call if the urge hits. You know, I used to have a little laminated thing, because I mentioned before I was a comedian, I worked as a magazine editor. I literally had, back then, before they had computers and desktop publishing, I would literally make these little cards that had like 20 names on them. Now we all have phones, okay? You've got no more excuse, you know, to call someone or text somebody. But these are things that were talked about more. We used to use the phrase, and it's a wonderful pamphlet. I don't know if you have it at the literature table. Before you pick up that first compulsive bite. That concept of the first compulsive bite used to be talked about so much more. If you don't know where that line is, how do you hold on to your abstinence? And that was an important thing I didn't get. The other great pamphlet they have over there is one called A Commitment to Abstinence, you know, making it the most important thing without exception. And I was explaining to somebody one day how I saw my commitment to abstinence. I said, imagine you're walking down a street and there's 100 bakeries, one right after the other. And I, as a compulsive and abstinent compulsive eater, I'm going to walk and I'm going to open the door to that first bakery and I'm going to go looking at all that stuff. I'm going to smell the smell of the bakery and I'm going, nope, I don't do that. I'm in OA. I'm abstinent. And I'm going to walk to the second bakery and I'm going to do the same thing. And I'm going to walk to the third bakery. Well, by the time I get to the 99th bakery, I'm going to be going, you know, I've been so good so far. I can probably have a little something. But you know what the commitment abstinence is? You walk down that street and you don't even see the bakeries. You know, and that's the thing that changes. That 10-step promises of it will be removed, you know. And that is the key. And it doesn't come overnight. It may come through a point of it being really tough. But you, if you keep working on this, it will be that way, you know. I always say, I believe my absence was a gift. At one point, like I said, my higher power said, okay, you know, we'll give him a break, see if he can hold on to it. I don't believe I can commit to staying abstinent, because that's a gift from my higher power. What I can commit to is to putting as many impediments between me and that first compulsive bite as I need to, you know, and to be willing to absolute commit to making calls if I need to, or any of the things that they talk about in this program. You know, it is the thing to do. You know, I sponsees going, I'm dealing white knuckle abstinence. I said, you know, it's not the way, it's not the optimum thing, but if you have a choice between white knuckle abstinence and eating, take the white knuckle abstinence, you know? It's better. And one of the things I explain to them is, especially if they're going through some really tough stuff, maybe they've only got, you know, let's say 6-8 months, but they're really going through something. I go, look, when I came into AA, one of the things I used to say is think it through. Think that first drink through. Where does it take you? And what I'll say to them is, okay, you've got 8-9 months of abstinence. You're really going through something now, right? What's going to happen? You go out and you binge, and then you come back. And maybe you get the abstinence right away. Maybe you slip and slide for a long time. Eventually, let's say you get the abstinence again, and you get to 8 or 9 months again, and you get to the same kind of problem you're having today. What are you going to do? Are you going to just keep on that loop of doing that over and over? The best way to deal with things is to go through them. Because when you go through them, things can change, you know, but you have to be willing to do that. And, that whole thing, think it through. And having that real commitment. We used to have a guy named, our nickname for him was Cinco de Mayo Frank. Because Frank was he was like an ex-Marine, got the buzz cut and you know, and he was Hispanic. And he used to get my abstinence date is Cinco de Mayo 1985 or whatever it was. And Frank was like a hardcore, he was in a couple of programs. And he used to get a newcomer as a sponsee and he'd say, all right, why don't you go over and buy a big book, come back. So the sponsee would come back with the big book. He says, okay, open that first page. You know, you got a pen? Okay, pull out a pen. Okay, I want you to write two things down in that book. I want you to write your name, and I want you to write today, because this is your abstinence date. Now, one of those can change. Guess which one? And he meant the name. In other words, be willing to make the commitment to that. But the thing, you know, the problem I was having when the slip was going is I didn't want recovery. I wanted to be recovered already. You know what I mean? I wanted what those old timers had, but I didn't want to do the work they did. But you know, if you want what we have, you know, it's all about. I mean, page 58 in the big book, the how it works. It couldn't lay it down more simply. You know, half measures avail us nothing. It talks about with complete abandon. It talks about that willingness to go to any lengths. You know, page 28 it says with all the desperation of drowning men. And when I was going through that slip, I wasn't attacking this problem with that kind of, you know, thing. I just wanted the absence fairy to hit me on the head, you know. And I heard somebody say once, you know, who do you want making the decisions in your life, you or your disease? You know, I would go to a restaurant that had shitty food but good bread, you know, because that happened to be one of my binge things, you know. And I looked and go later, I go, that it was so dumb, you know. But, you know, I think the other thing is I kept hearing the mantra that I hear this in way more in the food programs than I hear in the other program. It's that keep coming back mantra. Keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. You know, over it's not like they never say it in the other programs, but they have more of an attitude of, look, there's the door. If you got some more field testing to do, go ahead. We're here. When you come back, there is a solution. And an old timer say once, any damn fool can navigate the doorway, you know. But what it came down to is I kept thinking keep coming back just meant someday I'll just miraculously want it to change. And in some ways, hanging out, I think it elongated my relapse because I kept believing I was doing something about it when all I was doing was coming and sitting in meetings, you know. I needed the surrender. You know, they always talk about the idea, concept of compliance versus surrender, you know, to really be willing to say, okay, I want this and I'm willing to go to any lengths. You know, as Harlan always says, surrender is just joining the winning side, you know. I love that, you know. But in part of it, again, just, you know, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. In the big book, the page 48 talks about being beaten into a state of reasonableness. I just always found that such a funny phrase. But let me talk about the powerlessness, because that was the other thing I just didn't understand. I would get up there, just like with all these other things, you know, like the disease, you told me I was powerless. So in the middle of my, you know, I'm good little student. I'm parroting back. Yeah, I'm powerless over food. I'm powerless over food. And then I'd go eat. And then I'd come back and go, I'm powerless over food. Powerless over food. And I'd go eat again. I'm powerless over food. Binge. Powerless over food. Binge. Well, think about that for a minute. How powerless did I really think I was? Was I saying, oh, the heck with OA. I'm leaving. I'm never coming back. No. What was in there, I wouldn't even admit it to myself, and I couldn't see it until I looked backwards years later. I was saying to myself, when I'm done, I will come back, and I will get abstinent again. And the reason I would say that is I could. I had the empirical proof. Anybody who has ever been on one of those relapse cycles, who has broken their abstinence and gotten it back over and over and over, thinks and believes they can do that. Why? Because they have. I knew if I went off and did a relapse, I could come back and I could grind that train to a halt again. Now, I might take a lot of work. I might have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I may have to get a new sponsor. He may have me do all kinds of writing. But I would eventually get the, quote, abstinence again. The trouble is, the moment I had the food down, the clock was ticking on me going out again. Why? Because food was an option. And what it took me years to get was, I am powerful over the food in that small picture. But in the big picture, I was totally powerless. You know, I believe today I am powerless over a bullet and a gun. You know how why I believe that, and what the perfect example of how I believe that? I have never picked up a gun and put it to my head, and as I'm pulling the trigger, say, well, I'll start again on Monday. You know, I get that's not going to happen. But I also know with that disease, this disease, that is essentially what could happen to me. You know, I talked about Jim with the pictures that are going around, and Dan, the pictures going around, and Murray. The really scary thing for me about all three of those guys who are dead now is it wasn't like they never had abstinence. They had it, and they gave it away. You know, and if I could get in a time machine and go back to that day when Murray picked up that first bite and say, Murray, don't do it. If you do this, you're going to go out and binge. You're going to have trouble. Then you're going to come back, and then you're going to slip and slide and have some problems. You get a little disgusted. Well, wait, you're going to go off for about 3 or 4 months, and then you're going to come back, and you're going to slip and slide some more, and then you're going to go out, and then you're going to die. And if I had been able to say that to him at the point of that first compulsive bite, it would mean a lot more to him than it did at that exact moment he picked up that first compulsive bite. And the reality is, none of us have a guarantee that our next first compulsive bite won't take us to that exact same spot. And I mean, I've done a lot of work on the steps and everything, but if the stuff hits the fan, and that's all I could think about is this could cause me to die, it was one extra little wall between me and going out. And I, you know, I don't want to do that, you know. And that was the thing, is I couldn't get that powerlessness. When I first came in, we used to hear a lot. The old timers can remember. Used to always hear, we don't eat no matter what. You know, real hardcore. In fact, I think you actually had to hit the podium when you said it. I heard somebody say the exact same thing in a much nicer way a few years ago. She said that her sponsor said to her, if you're a compulsive eater and you've made food an option, it's always going to be the only option, isn't it? It's going to be the path of least resistance. If you have a choice of going through some emotional turmoil and pain, or eating something that A, you like the taste of, and B, makes you feel better and alleviates some of that pain, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? Who wouldn't choose that? And that's why it had to become, for me, Food can't be an option anymore. It can't be an option emotion. I can enjoy it. Again, it can be fuel. I can enjoy it at a meal. But it can't be the thing I turn to when I'm upset. And that was the thing that always happened to me with my disease, you know. And part of that is because I'm an emotional painophobe. I don't know about you guys. I don't like emotional pain. And I wanted always throughout my life, I got this from my family of origin, that there's something out there I can put in here that'll make me feel better. And the thing is that I wasn't growing because that was what my default turn to was. In other words, I was sort of like, you know, if I had to go through something, I was like a rat in a maze. You know, you put a rat in a maze and the whole idea is he's got to get out, so he's got to go down the right set of things. Well, I would go down the wrong one and bang my head at the end and then back all the way out and then go down the same damn one again, which was to go to the food, instead of working to try and get through the problem and get out the other side, you know? And that's, because that was my default, you know? And that was the problem. I couldn't get the powerless. I love the people, they talk about turning that around and saying we're powerless over life and our food had become unmanageable. I just, yeah. In a lot of ways, that's what it is, you know? It took me years to, when I talk about, I would always hear about our lives being unmanageable, having to do with just being in the disease. The longer I'm around, the more I get all of our lives are unmanageable if we really want to look at it. And it took me a long time to get that, you know. The trouble is that if you've come to the conclusion your life is unmanageable, the world gets really scary, right? You know, and all of a sudden you start thinking of what an uncertain world this is. And it can drive you crazy. And that's where you got to try and find some kind of a faith in something other than yourself. And that, you know, sort of takes you into the second step, you know. If I admit I have this problem and I'm powerless over it, I'm pretty well screwed, right? Unless, like it says, if I came to believe in a power greater than myself, you know, as an old timer said to me once, if you could have done this yourself, you'd have done it by now, you know, which is absolutely true, right? And in some ways, over in that other program, they'll be a little less touchy feely, and they'll say things like, you know, you've got a great IQ, and your own best efforts, all of your best work at dealing with your disease, got you where you were when you dragged your sorry ass in the first day, you know? And it was really true. I had no ability, you know? And I had to come to believe that there was something else. And I had such trouble. Again, I mentioned, I came from a very dogmatic religion in my childhood, and I ran away from it. And then I was a stark raving atheist for a long time. So when I came to program and I started seeing God and Him and all that stuff, I had a real problem with that. And I had to learn what that sponsor said about just leave it out in the beginning, you know. And I always say that I believe working the steps does not require a belief in any kind of a formal higher power. The most important thing for me is to understand that I am the lesser power, you know. I am the lesser power, you know. I think the key to recovery, you know, is the 12 steps as outlined in the big book. And it's not a matter of a conscious contact with a higher power alone. I think it's great. I think it's helpful, but I don't think it's required. Hopefully, if you keep working, you will find some kind of a belief in a higher power like I did. But for now, if you're an atheist or agnostic, or you're really having trouble with the G word, as I like to say, you can just put it on the back burner. And I'll tell you why. Because no matter what anybody here, if they have a belief in a higher power, believes about their higher power, I'll bet you believe that it's been around since before 1935, right? Right? Well, guess what? You know, people were dying of alcoholism without any hope of recovery until 1935. And you know what? Some of those people were priests, ministers, rabbis, nuns, cantors, whatever. And, it just wasn't helping. And it's the same thing with compulsive eating. People were dying without any hope of compulsive eating until 1960. And the thing about, I know, is if you think about all those priests, ministers, and rabbis who were dying of alcoholism, if it was simply a matter of a conscious contact with a higher power, I'm sure they believed they had that, you know. And I've always said I believe the steps and the big book and all that stuff, I believe it was God's gift to the 20th century, you know. It was the thing that made the real change. You know, it's the rowboat, I believe, that we're given to row to the shore of recovery, you know. And that's what those clergymen eventually had to do. They had to get into the same rowboat we're in and do the same work to get better. Because I know priests, rabbis, ministers, I know all of those people in this program, you know. And what I tell people and sponsees who are having trouble with us, look, I personally believe that this is a God-given program. Trust me, if you start reading the history of AA, I always say God played chess. You take a guy who's in Switzerland, who's seeing Carl Jung. He comes across back to the United States. He meets with this guy. He talks to his buddy. He decides to go upstate, into Vermont. And the guy's father is the judge who is about to sentence Ebby and says, well, if you go with my son and do this, maybe it'd get better. And then they come back down to New York, and then Ebby meets Bill Wilson, and then Bill Wilson goes to Akron, Ohio. I mean, coincidence? I mean, I got a limit on what I consider coincidence, personally. And it's okay. If you're an atheist, agnostic, it doesn't matter. I believe this rowboat has a thread going up to a higher power. If you don't believe that, fine. Cut that thread. Just believe in the rowboat. Believe in the steps. Believe in the program. And keep, like I was told, keep an open mind. You know, maybe you will find something. You know, the only thing you got to do is get in the rowboat. The only faith you need in the beginning is the faith in this process of recovery. You know, but here's the other thing: my higher power isn't going to do the rowing for me. You know, I was given the boat. The oars are there. I'm the one who still has to do this. You know. In the promises, it talks about God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. But I always say the other thing: God will not do for me what I can do for myself. You know, that's one of the other things I have to remember. I need to pick up the phone if the compulsion hits. I need to make sure I have a sponsor. I need to go to meetings. I need to do all the things I'm told to do. You know, no higher power has ever taken anybody's abstinence away, right? Never happen, you know. It's we give it away because we fall for that salesman's pitch over and over. Well, this time will be different, you know. You know, insanity doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, and that's what I believe. You know, and if you're having trouble, you know, with it, just look around. If you don't have trouble believing that this works, look around the rooms and see the people who were 100, 200. I mean, in my meetings, 100, 200. 300 pounds overweight, and they've been, you know, they've been coming back, you know. And it's like one of the things I'll tell you, a little pet peeve, okay, here's a start opinion. When people say, oh, I've lost 100 pounds, and everybody applauds, I it reminds me of Weight Watchers, you know. It really does, because I want to go, hey, I've lost that the three or four times, you know. It's like the guy who says, I quit smoking. I'm really good at quitting smoking. I've done it a number of times. But when somebody gets up and says, I've had 300 pounds and I've been keeping it off for 20 years, that's proof of the program as far as I'm concerned. And, so there is, you can have the faith just from looking at the evidence around program, you know. And just contrast that against, for me, was my lifelong inability to do anything with it. So there was a power greater than myself there when I was there on my first meeting, even though I was an atheist. And that was the power of these rooms and the power of people and the power of somebody who had one day when I had 0 days, you know, that, you could see that, you know. Because to me, one of the most important things about grasping the power, finding a power greater than ourselves, when it comes to my addiction, I am insane. Okay, now I'm not insane in terms of, you know, like something from a Bugs Bunny cartoon where I'm bouncing off. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! But I love this definition, that's out there that says. Insanity is the inability to hang on, I've got it written down. I'll talk about it in a minute because I have it written on the next page. I don't want to get it wrong. Oh, insanity is a state of mind that prevents normal perception. You know, I wasn't nuts, but I did not have normal perception. I'm a computer programmer now by trade. Now I don't do stand-up full-time anymore. And we have a phrase in computer programming called GIGO, G-I-G-O, and it means garbage in, garbage out. How can I make good decisions about my food and my stuff if I don't have good data on which to base it? And that's what my disease did. It was always trying to skew the data so I wouldn't make the right decisions. Well, that's insanity, you know? And You know, I had to believe that some power out there was greater than myself. And in the beginning, it was the meetings, it was sponsor. And it was so hard for me, though, you know, to for a lot of people to grasp that concept of insanity, because it's such a subtle thing, isn't it? It's not like, you know, if all of a sudden I come to and I'm standing in the middle of traffic, you know, wearing a tutu, I'm going to be like, man, I'm messed up. I better not trust, you know, anything. But I'm so competent in so many other areas. And I've been around OA for a long time. We're a way above average group. And we're so competent in so many other areas that we can't grasp that this one sliver of area, I am insane in that I do not have normal perception and that I need help mainly. I mean, I have a sponsor today who has less time than me in program. It's okay. It's about an objective person who can give me feedback, who has no investment in what I eat or don't eat, but can be, you know, and I need that kind of thing, no matter how long you're in program, you know. You know, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I always say my disease will whisper and be as subtle as it needs to be imperceptible, you know, to make me convinced it was actually my idea, you know. And, you know, I always talk about that my disease today won't whisper to me and go, oh, go, you know, go to 7-Eleven and buy up a bunch of ice cream, because it knows I'll just laugh and go, thanks for sharing. But it'll keep backing up. Can you get me in by, well, you know, you can start eating this food again. No, I tried that many times. Thank you very much. It'll just keep backing up and backing up and backing up and backing up until it gets to the point. Maybe it's, you know, I'm going to so many meetings. Maybe I don't need to go to as many meetings. And there, it's just done it, you know, because there was this movie years ago. You guys remember, I don't remember the name of the movie, but it was about an asteroid coming to Earth and it was going to hit Earth, and they'd figured out it was going to hit Earth. And what you learn is scientists have shown, if there's an asteroid heading to Earth, you can't go up and just blow it up, because then you're going to have 12 asteroids coming to Earth at you. But if you go far enough out, way, way out, all you have to do is nudge it an inch. An inch by 500 million miles will miss us. The asteroid will miss us by a load. Well, that's what my disease does. It keeps backing up, and then nudge, nudge. And then instead of being on the path of recovery, I'm slowly veering off, you know. And that's the thing that makes this cunning, baffling, and powerful, is it can literally be the slightest nudge that can make it happen, you know. I mean, in the book, in the big book, there's three wonderful stories about the insanity of the disease. You know, the first is the thing about Jim and the whiskey and the milk. A lot of you guys have read that story. And then there's the story of the jaywalker, you know. And then there's the story of Fred, who had the strange mental blank spot, you know. And I used to always think of those as, oh, they're just reiterating the same insanity story. But, you know, I thought there are three different kinds of insanity there. You know, the whiskey is about that crazy impulse thinking. Oh, this, I knew what I could do. I can put the whiskey in the milk, it'll be okay, right? That's impulse. My disease convinces me to do something that later I look back and go, that was nuts, you know, but I couldn't see it in that exact moment. The jaywalker is doing that same thing over and over and expecting a different result, right? And even no matter how much I see that it's bad, somehow this time it'll be different, you know? And then Fred in the strange mental blank spot, like it's like the whiskey, but instead of the warped logic about doing it, it's that almost absolute blocking out of realizing, you know, right from wrong in that moment, you know. And but that's the thing, is that, you know, we have a predilection for wanting to believe those things our disease says. You know, like I was saying last night, you know, if I get the lottery emails, I laugh at them. But when it talks about, oh, maybe I could do this, you know, the easier, softer way, it's always going to be there. And, you know, the other thing about me, and we'll take a break, by the way, in about 15 minutes or so. And then when we come back, that was the other thing I was going to talk about. We're going to send an Ask It basket around. There's a bucket in the back. Maybe we can put some of the paper and pencils in it. And just sort of send it around. And if you think of something, you know, I've said you want to ask a question about, or something, that any kind of question you want to ask. Oh, there it is, Vanna. and we'll just sort of keep sending it around. In other words, maybe as it's going around right now, you don't have anything you want to ask a question about. But then like 2 seconds after it passes you, I say something that you've got a question about. So if we can just sort of keep it going around and then later, I will take some time and answer some of these questions, and we'll have that. And then after the break, I'll do some more talking and see if there's any Ask a Basket questions. And then like maybe to say the last half hour, we'll have sharing, you know, so that I'm not the only one babbling up here. The other thing about it, you know, having this great brain that I had, I can look back now and realize that part of my problem was also I relied so much on my intellect. I did it to the at the expense of emotions. I wanted to make everything about intellect, and I wanted to deny and not look at emotions because, again, I got raised with emotions are scary and horrible, you know. But, you know, once it came to the idea of grabbing an idea of a higher power that can help me, you know, it comes down to what it says on page 45 in the big book about, you know, the aim of this process is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. Again, a lot of these priests and ministers had a higher power, but they had never considered about being something that could help them with their problem. And even when I came in, I'm like, okay, even if I believe in a God, you know, the idea that this higher power is going to help me with this stupid little eating problem, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. I multitask like crazy all the time. Do I really believe there's a God up there that can't multitask? Like him helping me with my compulsive eating means he's going to have to let a war go on somewhere else, you know? You know, and I can understand today and make a connection that I can have a higher power that will help me with my problems. But when I talk about higher power a lot, too, I'm a great believer. When I came in, I learned about the idea of a grounded out idea of a higher power, grounded out in sort of reality. And by that, I mean, I believe in higher powers, plural. And in particular, God, myself, and another human being. I think that is so important, you know. I always say that I can go off up to the mountaintop and commune and pray and meditate to my higher power and come down and tell you that God told me that chocolate's a vegetable and I can start having it. Yeah. But then when I call up my sponsor and say, you know, God told me chocolate's a vegetable, he's going to be like, not for today. Meaning that here's the real problem is in terms of prayer and meditation. If I pray and meditate, I don't know what's the voice of my higher power and what's the voice of my disease just doing a really good impression of my higher power. And that's why I need to ground all this stuff out. It says in the big book, not the big book, it's in AA 12 and 12, I think in the second step about going it alone in spiritual matters is dangerous, that I need to have a grounded out idea of a higher power. And, you know, and if you're new and you're having trouble with that concept, just make it the group. Make it a sponsor. Make it somebody who's got a day more than you. And I always joke about it. I say when I came in, and especially when I was coming back from my relapse, I needed a sponsor way more than I needed a higher power. You know, now I know today my sponsor was a bridge to my higher power. But in the beginning, I needed somebody who could help me in the real world, you know. Mainly because I have those strange mental blank spots and I can't see them myself. I need somebody to help me with them. I got the broken brain that can't fix the broken brain. And the other thing is I had to realize, and it's come over years, the idea of my own understanding. That is such an important thing that was added. God of my own understanding, because everybody has a different idea. And I had to through a lot of trouble for many years with just the word God. You know, it brought back so many memories of childhood and school and things like that. And I realized today, I just use it because it's a nice one-syllable placeholder, right? And it means something different to almost everybody here, right? You think about, if you go to a stop sign, and I say, what color is that stop sign? Everybody here is going to say red, right? Well, how do you know that what you're seeing as red, I'm not seeing as blue? And you know what I mean? And this person, he's seeing is green. But we've all made the collective decision to say, that there is red, right? And it's the same with a higher power. It can be anything. And when I say that, it is to you what will help you. And again, something that will help you with your problem. You know, and again, the one thing I got early on in 12-step program was the guy said to me, the only thing you gotta understand about God is you're not it, you know? And I needed to hear that. Not that I psychotically thought I was God, but I took on so much responsibility for things I did not have to. You know, if You know, if the mat over there was up a little and I stepped in and I didn't do anything about it and somebody tripped, oh, I should have done something about that. Or I should, you know, I took so much responsibility. Today, I've learned everybody's got their own higher power. I got to just take care of myself. My sponsees, if they slip, I didn't cause it. I can't cure it. And if they take a candle for 15 years, I don't get to say, hey, you see what I did? You know, everybody's got their own higher power. You know, and the other thing, I wanted all those questions answered. Well, how can there be a God if there's a Holocaust? How can there be a God if there's cracked babies? And remember my old sponsor going, well, if you understood that, you'd be God. And I just want to hit him, you know, but it's really true. It's not like it's, and the other thing is my higher power doesn't care whether I believe or not. It's still there. And I needed to remember that. And for me, what came is, it just came down to I had, you know, Bill Wilson had the flash of light moment of a higher power. I had more, and most of us here had that thing that they talk about in the spiritual experience, more of the educational variety. You know, how long do I keep seeing coincidences, quote unquote, before I start to go, well, maybe there's a little more here than I want to admit, you know? And it's also about getting, you know, some idea of humility about it, too. You know, I came in a day early, I meet my brother, and we went up and drove up to Mount St. Helens. And if you want to get a little lesson in humility, be driving along mile after mile seeing, you know, trees blown over, and you get an idea, man, we're all just these little ants up here, right? Yeah, we are, you know? You know, that the story about the bear, we're not even at the top of the food chain, folks, you know? And just to remember, you know? And when it came to, you know, the other thing about coming to believe in a higher power in the second step is I had to first, if I was going to find a connection with a higher power, I needed to deconstruct what I was given as a child. You know, it's like if you're going to build, you're going to want to work on a house, you know, you pretty much have to tear down what was already there to rebuild back up what you want. If it's going to be something that is going to work for you personally, and that's what I needed to do. I got raised with a kind of family where, like, I remember one time I slammed my finger in a door, and my mother said, "See, God's punishing you." Well, who the hell would want a higher power like that, right? You know, the other things, I mean, and this is just my own personal things. I have trouble when people talk about God as a male, you know. I am descended from two lines of nasty Irish alcoholic men, you know, who drank and were nasty and probably beat their wives. I'm going to have trouble seeing an all-loving higher power that's a male. It just doesn't work for me. Everybody has to find their own thing. But and for some people, believe in a God within themselves, a God of nature. You know, one of the things I tend to believe sometimes is the idea of raising above our animal nature. You know, out in the real world, or out in the world, you know, animals, they care about self-preservation, right? That's an animal nature. Yet you pick up stories of GIs in battle who will dive on a hand grenade to save their buddies. To me, that's a higher level. And it's the kind of thing I want to aspire to, not to just be, you know, in that whirlpool of self. And some of that, realize that comes from nature, you know? I think if you can't get there, then just think about a sponsor in the beginning when it comes to the second step. In step three, where I always say it's where the reality and the theory meet. And in particular, if you're new and all you can do in the beginning is get a sponsor, great. Your third step is really simple. It's called take direction. You know, I used to hear that a lot more when you came in. Take direction. Don't you realize your disease is going to want to negotiate? You know, we got a guy down in my neck of the woods named Ira who says you can't negotiate with your disease. It's always going to win. And that's why I needed to have a sponsor who helped me with some of those things, you know. I had to realize, again, I'm crazy. I need to listen to somebody else. And somebody's at least objective when it came to the food. You know, if I'm really willing to go to any lengths, I don't get a sponsor and then start arguing with them about it, you know. I have to be willing to surrender for a while. You know, I've done it my way for so long, maybe I can try in a different way. And it was especially true when it came to my food and working on a food plan, you know. But one of the hardest things for me is I used to always hear that phrase, turn it over, turn it over. And I just had such a time grasping what that, you know, meant. You know, I was used to joke, you know, if you turn something over twice, it's right side up again, you know. You know, And what I read in the AA 12 and 12, there's something in the third step, and I finally read it in a particular way that I sort of turned around. Instead of saying about turning it over, I changed it to be remove the blockage of self-will. Get out of the way, you know? And that, to me, is more of about what the third step is for me, you know? And again, that's hard. You know, having some kind of faith was really hard for me. You know, I come from children of alcoholics. I had parents, both of them, who would say one thing one day and the next day when they sobered up, totally different. And it just smashes your trust mechanisms. And if any of us have been around and had their trust mechanisms smashed, it's hard to trust first in another human being like a sponsor, but it's even harder to try and come to a concept of a higher power that you can't see and be willing to trust in. And that's where it took a long time for me to get, you know. One of my first meetings, and this guy got up and he was this old, you know, crusty old-timer, and he was Catholic. And he said, you know, I had to get to be 65 years old before I realized I could, and come to AA before I could realize I could pray to God without going through Rome. And it's true about finding something that's different, you know, because the trouble was that whatever higher power I had when I came in wasn't really God. It was Santa Claus. You know, I got this list, okay? And if you give me the things on this list, then I will believe in you, you know? Well, that's not God. That's Santa Claus, you know? Or I'm in a scrape, you know? Whatever it was, my prayer to God would end with, and I'll never drink again, you know, or something like that. But when I came in, and I just drove my sponsors crazy because this great intellect wanted to figure out what my higher power is and, you know, all that. And somebody said once, God can't be understood with the brain. It has to be felt from the heart. And it really, it took me years to really get that's exactly true, you know? And for me, my higher power thing today is everything's happening exactly the way it's supposed to be. You know, I may not like it. You know, they talk about acceptance doesn't mean you like it. You just accept it, you know? And to realize that. This is a great thing I'll read here from Steve Jobs. He was giving a commencement at Stanford, and I just love this. It says, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will someday connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down. It has made all the difference in my life. And, you know, if you hear that with words, you realize what that is? That's just a secular serenity prayer, I think. You know, it's accepting the things you can't change, realize you're going to turn around later and realize how the dots connected. And that helps me, especially you get to my age, you've had enough things happen that you thought were the worst thing that ever happened. And then when you turned around backwards and said, wow, that thing I thought that was the worst thing happened, if that hadn't happened, this wouldn't have happened, which meant that great thing wouldn't have happened to me. And if you have enough of those, then when the lousy thing happens, you go, oh, this is on the road to something really cool. I guess we'll find out in a little while. And, you know, and again, you know, the what they call AA's thesis sentence in page 45 in the big book, you know, the big book's main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that'll help you with your problem. You know, I not only needed a higher power, I needed to find a relationship with a higher power. And that's the thing that took a long time. You know, I needed to see myself as the lesser power. I needed to be teachable, you know. They talk about how we eat over what's eating us, and the other thing about filling that God-shaped hole in us. That's one of the things that happened, right? And so I was talking about steps 1, 2, and 3. Mostly I was gearing this to people who are new or coming out of relapse. It was a couple months ago now. I mentioned that we do these Sunday special editions for that Vision for You. And I did one called Working the 15 Steps. And what that is that I believe in a lot of ways the first three steps are attacked differently if you're new or coming out of relapse versus being around for a long time, the first three steps. And so I'll just talk about what I think the first three steps for me and my stage of recovery are about. For me, it's about, you know, living life in a 12-step manner, you know, answering to a higher power. And realizing that the first three steps really boil down to, you know, if I took, you reduced everything you learn in these books into three phrases, it's the serenity prayer, isn't it? You know, reduce. I use a cooking term for OA. Reduce, you know. But if you think about it, it's about accepting the things you can't change, having the courage to change the things you can, and, of course, the big gotcha, the wisdom to know the difference, you know? And my old sponsor used to grab the skin on the back of his hand and go, right here, kid, that's where the difference is. Everything from the skin out, things you can't change. Everything from the skin in, things you can. Which, if you think about it, 98%. Well, yeah, there is a small amount of things I can change in my immediate little circle, but most of it, the only thing I can change is my reaction to things, you know? I love that line from another 12-step program I'm in, act, don't react. I spent so much of my life just in react mode all the time. And so, you know, the thing about the first step for me today, you know, this amount of years in, it's about I am powerless over people, places, and things. Yes, I'm also powerless over the food, but that's under control. I am powerless over people, places, and things, and life in general. You know, again, I come from a time, and as being a child of alcoholics, control was a desperate thing. I needed control. You know, shrink-wise, I had control issues, as they like to say. But what it was about was, in the way I grew up, it was about safety and security. And the more things I can have control over, the safer my world gets, you know? And the longer I'm around, the more I realize that it wasn't control. They were all illusions of control, right? You know, you think about how little control we have over so many things in life. You know, I was talking to somebody one day about how I went off and became a stand-up comic, and I was a full-time stand-up comic for about 15 years, and then I had done computer stuff earlier, and I got back into computers, and that's what I do now, and I'm an independent contractor. So I haven't actually worked for somebody for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. And a person said, oh, I could never do that. I have to have the security of working for a company, you know, something substantial, you know, and getting that paycheck every week. I said, so you mean like you'd be okay with, let's say, a big corporation, like let's say the number three corporation in America, right? And you want to go in and work in a place like in a downtown of a big city that's a big skyscraper and that kind of a corporation. Yeah, that's what I want. Okay, so now let's say that city is Houston, Texas, and let's say that building belongs to Enron, and you work for Enron, like those people worked for Enron and thought they were working for this great corporation. They show up one day, and the door is locked. And you all of a sudden get the idea of how many things that we think are okay are all illusions of control. And boy, if you don't find some kind of a concept of a higher power, you're going to drive yourself nuts, you know? And that was the thing I had to start realizing, you know? The first step, if I do this stuff and I really give up control and I really stop trying to do people, places, and things, it frees me from the frustration, you know? It gives me a little more contentment. I'd love to say that everything I talk about program, I do for these Gandhi-like reasons of being this, wonderfully evolved person. The reality is almost all these things at one level or another are selfish. I'm the one who doesn't walk around with my guts churned up. I'm not the one worrying about the world. I'm the one who can get to a more peaceful and serene life. But, you know, and that's why I do a lot of these things. You know, I remember talking one day about, I was some kind of frustration thing with something that happened in my life. And my sponsor said to me, you know, John, everything that you deal with that's frustrating, you amplify it. You amplify it by having the subtext of, and it's not supposed to be this way. John, it's exactly the way it's supposed to be. Your higher power decided this is the way it's supposed to be. The guy in the left lane of the freeway who's driving 40 miles an hour, God wants him to drive 40 miles an hour. I don't want him to be driving 40, but these days I'll move around him. You know what I mean? But I used to just get so frustrated with that kind of thing. And the answer is that it's in what Dr. Paul says in on the acceptance chapter. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And that's what I had to learn, you know. And I don't like it sometimes, but it's the truth. You know, some people do a powerlessness inventory. I always like that idea, you know, to be able to look at what things frustrate me and what can I actually do about them, you know. Accepting other people as they are, you know, as God wants them. This great guy, Michael Kay from Denver, who always says, bless them, change me, you know. And I think it's an important thing. That's, for me, that's the first step today. Step two, again, I'm still insane by the idea of a state of mind, prevents normal perception. I think this is true of all of us. We're guided by our character defects. I'll talk about those a little more. But, you know, it comes down to what it says on page 62. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of the problem. But the trouble is, again, I mentioned this before, these are things the program teaches us that we almost have to fight evolution, don't we? No, you really think about it. We're all descended from, we're the ones who made it. Right? We're at the end of the chain of the ones who, for all I know, if I went back in time, one of my ancestors might have been the caveman who pushed his best friend in front of a saber-toothed tiger so he could live. You know? We have all been inbred with this, that I got to worry about myself. I got to take care of myself. And now the program is saying, no, you got to start thinking of it differently. You've got to take yourself out of the center. And it isn't an easy thing the program teaches us, to do. You know, it talks about thinking of other people first. And that's not, you know, easy. We need to realize that the higher power has a different plan. And the third thing, and I'm going to wrap up in just a minute, the idea of turning my will and my life over to this new way of living, you know, to remove the self as much as possible is a daily task for me to try and do, you know. And God, if we could get the world to do that, right? You know, I was a stand-up comic, but I also did a lot of improv for a number of years. And in improv class, they teach you, don't try and get the laugh. Try and get the other laugh for him. Try and get the other laugh for your buddy. And if you do that for him, he's going to be doing it for you, and we're all going to work out. And if all of us, instead of looking at ourselves, was worrying about the other guy would be worrying about us, and we'd all end up there. And, I mean, I think this is what the basis of what this is about, and I really believe that. And, you know, part of the reason I had trouble, and I was always grasping for this selfishness, was the fear that I wasn't going to get enough. I had to reach for it. I had to grab for it because I wasn't going to get what I needed. You know, it's just not true. I'll tell you what one of my theories about. Okay, this is goofy, but I'm going to say it anyway. Some of the major things I've learned in life came from Bugs Bunny cartoons. Okay. There used to be this Bugs Bunny, and it has to do with what I believe about my life, especially having looked back at it. There was this Bugs Bunny cartoon where they start building a skyscraper right over where Bugs Bunny's hole is. And he's annoyed, so he goes up on this skyscraper. It's one of these quintessential things of all it is girders, and it goes up God knows how many stories, and he climbs all the way up, you know, near the top of this skyscraper, and there's nothing but girders, and something happens, he gets hit in the head, and he, you know, goes senseless, you know, with the birds chirping, and he's walking along this girder where he could fall off at any minute, and he's not even paying attention to that. And as he gets to the end of the girder, there's a girder swinging by on a rope with a crane, and he steps onto that girder and walks along that girder, and just about the time he gets to the end of that girder where he's going to fall off, it comes up and hits the building and he steps right off. Well, I know that sounds weird, but it's sort of what I felt has happened in my life. Everything that's happened, it's always worked out, you know? Everything has gotten me okay. And if I can believe, looking backwards, that that's the situation, maybe I can have faith that that's the way it's going to happen in the future, you know? And that, you know, it's what I got to believe in. You know, there's that great line from Robert Browning, God's in his heaven and all's right in the world. I just have to accept that and have some faith, you know. I was talking to my mother. My mother, after she quit drinking, she was like, got back into her church. And she said, oh, you got to get back into the church and it's wonderful, you know, and the faith. And so then I try and get her to come out to Florida, to California. She lived in Florida and she was afraid to fly. And I kept going, Mom, come on, you got to come out. And so I started giving her a hard time. I'm like, hey, you talk about having faith, you know? And you know, what about it? You know, the fear is lack of faith. And she said to me one day, so you can tell me that you believe God will keep you from dying in a plane crash? I said, Mom, I live next to Santa Monica Airport. If God wants me to die in a plane crash, he'll bring it to me in bed, you know? And that's where I'm at today. I mean, the idea that I have faith that he's going to be okay, you know. It's about getting out of the bondage of self, the whirlpool of self, I think, which amplifies all my problems. And I remember, the concept of why was the one that really hurt me the most. You know, I heard why is the most useless word in the English language. Because when you're asking yourself why, it's about something that happened that you don't like. And if you get Y answered the way you want to, which is what, about 0.0001% of the time, if you get it answered the way you want to, you're right where you started. But when you don't get Y answered right, you're frustrated and feel, you know, things aren't fair. And I got taught, learn to lose the Y. You know, I would have something happen when I worked at a company, and I'd go, why did that happen? And it didn't matter how what happened. I had to take care of the problem. And to lose the why, it helped a lot, you know. I had to have some more faith because I used to spend a lot of time, trying to play the chess game of life, you know. I wanted to be prepared for things that could happen, so I'd be always thinking about what was going to happen right ahead, you know. Well, if I do that, he'll do that, and then I'll do that. And all I ever did, and I would always do that out to the worst-case scenario as a way of telling myself I feel better. And all I did was traumatize myself, you know. Or I'm going to meet with this guy, and I'm going, well, I'm going to say that, and he's going to say this. And then I'm going to say, but no, and I'm going to give him this reason, and he's going to say no, and I'm going to give him this reason. And I go into the meeting, and I say the first thing. He goes, oh, yeah, you're right. No, wait, I got this great argument all laid out, you know. But they realized that I was doing a lot of that and traumatizing myself, you know. I heard a guy at a meeting say the most brilliant thing. He said, I had mistaken worrying about something as being the same as doing something about it. And I thought how often I did that somehow worrying was going to make it. Yes. I had mistaken worrying about a problem as being the same as doing something about it, you know. And today, I have a belief in a higher power, you know. And I can't guarantee there's a higher power out there. But what's the worst thing that happens to me if I'm wrong? I've led a more peaceful life, you know. I wanted it, you know, figured out before. But that's what it's about, you know, and acceptance and accepting the things no matter what they are, you know, not necessarily liking them. And one of the worst things, the hardest things for me as the child of an alcoholic is change. I don't know about you guys, you know, change. And I used to argue. And I heard somebody say a great line once, and then we'll break. Change isn't painful. Resistance to change is painful, you know. So I'm sorry, I ran a little long on this. We'll take a break for a little while and come back, and maybe I'll answer some questions. And I'll do a little more, and then we'll have some sharing. So let's take a